I would like to try to give you the opportunity to ask questions and make comments, because it seems to me that it is very important that this is not a one-way assimilation process. So as we go through the talk, if you could be thinking about questions you might like to ask or comments you'd like to make, and write them down, we shall try to give some open time at the end to do precisely that. Now, I would like to start by reading the second half of the first chapter of Daniel's book, which discusses with us the incident in his university life that set a compass bearing for all the rest of that life, because it raises profound issues that affected not only him and his friends, but are of utmost relevance to us in our day. Daniel 1 then, in verse 8, "But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way." Now, God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink, and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them. He found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. We have seen how Daniel begins his book by sharing with us his view of history. He believed that history had a significance, that history is moving somewhere. He believed that there is a God behind history, and that it was God who permitted King Nebuchadnezzar to conquer King Jehoiakim and to transport him and Daniel and some of the nobility to Babylon. He saw it as no mere accident of the convulsions of the power games of history. He saw it rather as the inexorable fulfillment of the moral dictates of God, who will, when men persist in compromising in their lives with idolatrous thinking and practice, who will in the end allow them to experience what it is like to live in a nation that is thoroughly riddled with those same practices. So it was simultaneously a judgment of God that befell the nation, as it was a unique opportunity for Israel to do what God had chosen her to do, to be a witness to the big world, to the superpowers that then existed. Men like Daniel are rare in history. The Bible records only two at that level, Joseph and Daniel, and possibly Nehemiah. Men of such integrity and character that God chooses them to be witnesses at the highest level. And therefore those of us who witness by definition at lower levels may be encouraged as we seek to understand what it is that formed the mainspring and motivation of men of faith like Daniel. It started in the refectory at King's College, Babylon. Students, like anyone else around the world, eat and like to eat. And that is a habit that they usually do not lose with a lifetime. And it is interesting to see how much there is in Scripture about meals. Because meals in the ancient world were not fast food out of the fridge or McDonald's, where the family never sat together and became atomized by its failure to take even the elementary things of life together. Meals were important occasions. They were times of discussion. They were times of building bonds. They were the times of telling stories, of filling the children's minds with the big picture into which life was to fit. It is not surprising, is it, gentlemen, that we live in a moral wasteland and an intellectual wasteland, when parents have no time to sit with their children, have no time to eat and discuss and raise the big issues of life. They're too busy for it. What a tragedy. And Christians of all people should be those who are setting an example in the way they make space and time for meals, for their family, for their wives, for their children, for their friends, because it's at meals that hearts get opened and minds get opened. In Oxford, as in King's College, Babylon, there are meals. And I have discovered over the last years what a wonderful opportunity they are to share the deeper things of life's experience and faith itself on occasion with men and women from every walk in life. And so it was in Babylon. But mealtimes can be dangerous too. Now I am aware, because I've read the books as well as you have, that there is great dispute among the experts as to what the central issue is here. Because there is no explicit mention in the text about this food in the university having been offered to idols, it is therefore deduced by some that that forms no part of the background. I beg to differ. Because it seems to me that any understanding of ancient Mesopotamia will show us that this was a country uniquely permeated by polytheistic worship. And actually, perhaps, we make a mistake in mentioning only the food, because in the way in which Daniel relates it, he mentions the wine equally often to the food. You've noticed that, haven't you? It was not that Daniel never took wine. You will read later in the book that he did. But it was that wine had a special significance, which we shall see with unmistakable clarity in chapter 5 of this book, when the vessels from the temple of God in Jerusalem were used to drink wine and simultaneously to praise the gods of wood and stone and metal. In a country that was so infected, so completely permeated by idolatrous thinking, it would have been inconceivable that in the major university, in its top school, that there would have been zero involvement of idol worship, particularly with the food, yes, but more particularly with the drinking of wine. Because all around the world, as we know, all around the world, it has been the habit of people to raise a glass and speak in praise of, well, other people often, but in ancient societies, it would have been the norm to speak in praise of the gods. And so a decision had to be made. Where was the protest to be held, and what form should it take? A line had to be drawn, but where? Scripture tells us where Daniel drew it. It leaves us to draw conclusions which are not always easy to draw, gentlemen. Because drawing lines is something that all of us find difficult. You will notice that their names were changed. We discussed the significance of that last night. They did not appear, at least it is not recorded, that they protested there. You might have thought that there was the place to protest. Not that they would have had any choice in it anyway. We are told their names were changed, that is all. But now the protest was to come. Of course, there would have been other reasons for Daniel and his friends to have a difficulty with the food. Because Daniel and his colleagues were Jews. And they stood in a biblical tradition where God had used certain food laws to teach them some fundamental distinctions in a rather elementary but very direct way. Part of their holiness code was taught to them by making distinctions between clean and unclean animals. The sanctity of life, of human life that is, was taught to them by the simple expedient of prohibiting them from eating blood. And then finally, of course, there were the subsequent clear prohibitions of eating food sacrificed to idols. So there would have been possibly three reasons at least to think seriously about what they were going to do about the food at that humble level. Those are, of course, important questions. Concepts of holiness and what it means to be devoted to God. And Daniel resolved not to defile himself. We have seen already on the positive side that those vessels in the temple symbolized those golden vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had pillaged from the temple, symbolized God. as Daniel's absolute value. And devotion to God as absolute value is, of course, what we mean by holiness. Holiness is not to be conceived of as merely a negative thing in the habit of some. Of course, it does involve a negative attitude to all that defiles the human heart and mind. But the negative is there in order to enhance the positive. I illustrate it sometimes at a very humble level. Some people take baths or showers from time to time, because they have probably noticed that if they don't, the circle of their friends gets smaller. So they separate themselves from dirt in order to enjoy the company of others. And that illustrates it well, doesn't it? The negative attitude towards dirt is not an end in itself, apart from those of you who spend hours in the bath. It's not an end in itself, but it is for the positive effect of setting us free to be comfortable in the company of others. And if we can see that at the ordinary human level, why is it we find it so difficult to see at the deeper spiritual and moral level? So Daniel, thinking of those golden vessels, so to speak, resolved not to compromise himself in this matter. And life too. Life and its sanctity. And across the Western world in particular, the lawyers drifting on the open sea of moral relativism find it harder and harder to know what is meant by the sanctity of life. British law, for example, knows nothing of a protection for the unborn child. The sanctities of life, we are going to have to face it on an increasing scale. And we need to know about it, don't we? And they were taught it in the ancient world. And Daniel believed that life was a sacred gift from God. Not a mere machine which you get rid of when you can find there's a better one. But life constituted in the image of God. But then there was the big question. The matter of what lay behind the universe and life. What is it that gives life its sacredness, its value? Is there anything behind this universe? And you see, protesting against the food is protesting against the idolatrous practices. But we must dig deeper. Protesting against the idolatrous practices is protesting against the basic philosophy that governed Babylon's thinking. What is being served up in our universities, in our colleges, in the corridors of power, in the media, in the literature? The food that feeds our minds is more dangerous than the food that feeds our bodies. And here's where we're going, gentlemen, to have to do some very hard thinking. You in your corner, I in mine. As to where and how and when and what we protest against. It is so easy to drift and think it's the job of others. If we took that attitude in our own profession, we would leave it very rapidly, wouldn't we? We'd have to. So easy to drift and not to think through what my responsibility is in these bigger questions. And so I want to analyze this just for a moment. We know what Daniel believed. He believed that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. His very name, God is my judge, bore witness to the belief in one unique transcendent God who was creator and upholder of heaven and earth. Not some remote God who was uninvolved, but the God of origins and continuity, and the God who watched his life with interest and loving concern. That was Daniel's God, and there was only one God. And now, as a 15 or 16 year old, he is plunged into a world of many gods to study their language and their literature. You will notice that emphasis. It's not only the language, it's the literature. And you will discover, as we read at the end of chapter 1, that he became an expert in the literature. He knew it backwards, of course. And he was able, therefore, to protest for the rest of his life against the basic arguments that lay behind the great creation myths of the pagan world. The Babylonian Enuma Elish, their great creation myth that was read once a year and the king had to listen to its public reading. The great Babylonian flood epic, Atrahasis. And there were others, Philo's cosmogony and Hesiod's theogony. The great myths of the ancient world. And they had certain common characteristics. Firstly, their accounts of the universe were polytheistic. They believed in many gods. Secondly, there is often a power struggle for supremacy among the gods. And the Enuma Elish is devoted to telling how Marduk succeeded in the power struggle among the Babylonian gods, so that by the time Daniel came to Babylon, Marduk was the supreme god of the Babylonians. Humans often appeared as an afterthought, made to lessen the work of the gods. And creation proceeded through the sexual union of the gods themselves. But perhaps most importantly of all, these were not merely cosmogonies, that is, descriptions of the origin of the universe. They were what is called theogonies. They were descriptions of the origins of the gods. That may strike us as very curious. But you see, when you dig underneath the surface, you will find that these Babylonian gods had not existed eternally, but they themselves had evolved out of the primeval matter of the universe. Everything goes back to the primeval sea, Namu. Oddly enough, the nearest thing they had in the ancient world to primeval soup. And so you see, their gods, which we might instantly think of as spirits, and they may have been like that, but originally they are material gods, in the sense that they proceed out of the original material of the universe. So in the end, in the last analysis, everything in the Babylonian universe, its gods, its world, its people, Everything was a product of matter and energy and nothing else. And now perhaps, gentlemen, you begin to see that this comes within a hair's breadth of the dominant philosophy of the Western academic world. There is very little difference between the Babylonian deification of the forces of nature and the contemporary thinkers who do essentially the same, as they regard the forces of nature in the end as the ultimate, not only controllers of nature, but the creators of nature itself. That is one of the reasons why I hold the book of Daniel to be of utmost relevance for the 21st century. Because although at first sight the notion of a Babylonian academic bowing in the university dining hall and giving his tribute to Marduk may seem light years removed from the Richard Dawkins of this world, the difference is but a hair's breadth, if anything at all. Denying God, contemporary minds are forced to invest matter and energy with creative powers. Because, of course, there is no option, is there? If there is no God, if there is no creator, then matter and energy must have the capacity to produce not only the universe, but you. That is why, of course, Lucretius, that brilliant Latin poet, came up with a theory of evolution that anticipated everything that Darwin has in his Origin of Species, except one thing, the transmutation of species. And Lucretius, in his brilliant poem, De Rerum Natura, on the nature of the physical universe, he got his theory by deducing it straight from the atomism of Democritus, the father of the atomic theory, that brilliant insight, but used to deduce that if you've only got atoms and energy, then those atoms and energy must have the capacity to produce everything. So you see, we are in a very familiar world, and it is the essence of idolatry to attribute to the creation, to the material of the creation, to the beings of creation, to the animals or humans, to attribute to creation and created things divine power. That is the essence of idolatry. And it is as rampant in the contemporary world as it was 25 centuries ago in Babylon. That's why we have to take it seriously. We now call this philosophy reductionism, that it holds that everything can be explained without remainder in terms of physics and chemistry. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work. I often sit talking to leading academics, and on several occasions, many in fact, I've used the following simple story to raise this issue. But let me tell you of one occasion, where I found myself at dinner with a biochemist, and he asked me, as we do under such circumstances, what I did. I said, I'm a mathematician. Oh, he said, how awful. I'm in for a boring evening then, because I don't know the first thing about mathematics. I said, no, you're not in for a boring evening, because I'm also interested in the philosophy of science and the big questions of life. He said, what do you mean the big questions? Well, I said, questions like, is there anything behind the material universe? He said, you mean questions like God and so on? I said, yes. Oh, he said, it's going to be worse than I thought then. He said, I'm an atheist. I'm a reductionist, and that's it, and we're in for a rough evening. That's a good way to start dinner. But I said, oh no, we're in for a fascinating time. He said, why? Well, I said, I just find reductionism one of the most interesting topics. I said, tell me, for starters, what kind of a reductionist are you? Are you a methodological reductionist? Because I'm one too. Take a big problem, split it up into little problems, study the little problems, and then see if you can put together what you've discovered about the little problems to give you some insight into the big problem. That's the way science works. I do it all the time. So do I, he said. Well, I said, we could agree at something, can't we? But I said, I suspect you're an ontological reductionist. You believe that being, ontos, being can be reduced to physics and chemistry. Yes, he said, that's exactly what I believe. It's nothing but physics and chemistry. Well, I said, I told you, I'm only a simple mathematician, but I run into immediate difficulty with the menu on the table. So I picked it up and showed it to him, and he studied it, and he said, roast chicken should be okay, what's the problem? And I said, well, the problem is not with the roast chicken. It's with the word roast chicken. He said, what do you mean? Well, I said, you believe that everything can be explained irreducibly in terms of physics and chemistry. He said, that's right. Well, I said, now, tell me. Explain to me the semiotics of these letters in terms of the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. Explain to me the way these letters carry meaning, roast chicken, in terms of the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. And there was a silence, which was rather embarrassingly broken by his wife, who dug him in the ribs, as I could see, and whispered rather too loudly for his comfort, get out of that if you can. But he didn't try. He said something that stunned me. He said, you know, John, for 40 years I've gone into my laboratory in Oxford thinking it could be done. But he said, it so obviously can't, can it? And I was so stunned, I said, hey, half a minute. Physics and chemistry have only been going for 300 or 400 years. Oh no, he said, that's no good either. You need to introduce a higher level explanation of an author, don't you? I said, that's right. And then he looked at me, and it suddenly dawned on him that I wasn't bright enough to have thought of that argument. And he said, where did you get that? Well, I said, I'd better confess it. From a Nobel Prize winner, from Roger Sperry, who won the Nobel Prize for medicine. The meaning of the message will not be found in the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. But it's not only roast chicken on a menu at an Oxford college, gentlemen. Every one of the 10 trillion cells of your body contains a database bigger than any encyclopedia. And as Francis Collins, who directed and still directs the Human Genome Project, stood and announced the almost completion of the writing down of the 3.5 billion letter sequence of the human genome, he said, it is humbling for me and awe-inspiring to realize that we have caught the first glimpse of our own instruction book, previously known only to God. DNA does not imply, writes Stephen Meyer, a philosopher of science, the need for an intelligent designer because it has some similarities to a software program or to a human language. It implies the need for an intelligent designer because it possesses an identical feature. namely information content, that intelligently designed human texts and computer languages possess. I find it strange, don't you, that an archaeologist can go into a cave and see a couple of scratched symbols like that and say, human intelligence. And yet the most brilliant minds in history can look at a 3.5 billion letter sequence and say chance and necessity. Odd, isn't it? Oh, I know what is said, so I might as well say it. The argument is very frequently heard these days that introducing God is an absurd non-explanation for the phenomena of life, because by definition, God is more complicated than the thing you're trying to explain. So what kind of an explanation is that then? Well, let me try it out on you. Suppose I'd said, which I did actually, to the man who reacted to the roast chicken and said, you have to introduce a human author. Suppose I'd said, don't be so silly. These are just simple symbols on a page, aren't they? I mean, you're not explaining anything when you say they are the result of a human author getting involved, because by definition, the human brain is far more complex than these symbols, isn't it? What's wrong with the argument, gentlemen? It's very simple. Simplicity is not the only criterion of truth. Einstein once says, keep things simple, but only as simple as necessary. Coherent explanation is a criterion of truth. Explanatory power is a criterion of truth. And we see a scratch in a cave and we say human intelligence. We infer from the lesser to the more complex instinctively. And yet succeeding generations of bright young men and women are taught to argue in the exact opposite direction when they first come across the coding in a human cell. You see, we have the choice between two philosophies. One was Daniel's, the other was Nebuchadnezzar's. For Nebuchadnezzar, it was in the beginning with the particles of energy, and everything, including the gods, comes from it. For Daniel, if he lived in a later age, he would have possibly said, and certainly would have agreed, with the opening statement of the fourth gospel, in the beginning was the Word. All things were made by him. You do not even get particles, let alone the genetic information in the cell, without the eternal Word. Oh, these are important issues, aren't they? And I'm tempted to speak at great length on them. But I'm going to resist the temptation, of course, and proceed. Because as we come back to Daniel deciding to protest, there is now the way he did the protest. Daniel was a very polite and sensitive and respectful young man. He was not aggressive. I find it very odd, gentlemen, that sometimes Christians can be more aggressive in the way they relate to one another and to others than it ought to be. In order to dialogue with people who do not agree with us, and that's the majority, we need to learn to respect those who do not agree with us. Let us never forget that our faith commits us to believing that every man and woman is a creature made in the image of God, however distorted that image has become, that one of the things I have to learn is to respect other people and to show it. We shall get nowhere in our witness if we become aggressive boars. Nowhere. Or if we've got such a conviction that we have the truth, that we have not time to listen to those who may equally feel that they have it too. Look how gentle Daniel was with this man. Daniel said to the guard, who was not the head of the language institute, Ashpenaz, he said, we would like permission. Didn't say we're not going to eat. You noticed that, didn't you? I've called it a protest, but we need to analyze that word rather carefully, lest we come up with wrong conclusions. No, he asked permission not to eat, and that led to a discussion. The man was very sympathetic, and he said, I'm afraid. Very interesting, isn't it? But Daniel had a close enough relationship to this man, who could have put him to death, I presume, had he wanted to, that the man was prepared to be honest and say, I'm afraid. They're afraid of Nebuchadnezzar, because Nebuchadnezzar was not a constitutional monarch who was subject to any laws. He was the law. Whom he would he slew? Whom he would he kept alive? As we shall learn in a later chapter. And if he woke up in the morning with a headache and you were the first one to meet, you might be relieved of your head and headaches forever. I'm afraid, said he. Why should the king see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. My life's on the line, young man. What you ask is too much. But Daniel spoke to the guard. So I presume the other man didn't really know what was going on then. He left it at that. But he spoke to the guard and he said, look, test us for 10 days. Take away this gourmet food and give us vegetables and water instead. And then judge the situation and act according to what you see. So now Daniel and his friends give the man an opportunity that he could get involved without risk, without losing face or his head. And so, after 10 days, the wine and the gourmet food having been removed, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. Well, you say, of course they did. And a lot of us would look better nourished if we cut out a lot of the stuff we eat too, wouldn't we? It's become a massive problem, isn't it? So you say, oh, there's nothing special about this, is there? They just stopped going to McDonald's and that's it. Well, there's a lot of truth in that. But it's a question of perception, isn't it? There was more to it than that. Of course, at one level, the vegetables and the water might well have been healthier for them, but 10 days isn't a very long time to see the difference. And you can see that God was taking a hand in it behind the scenes and honoring their stand, because the crucial thing was the perception on the part of the man who removed the food. And he could see that there was a difference. And so he allowed it to stand. But let's think just for a moment about his fear. He was afraid, this Ashpenaz and the guard too, that they wouldn't look as well as the others. And of course that was meant physically, because there was a great, among the Babylonians and the Greeks later, and the Romans, there was a great linkage between